This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In his position as Newsweek's Middle East editor and Paris bureau chief, Christopher Dickey is in a good position to discuss political changes happening through the Middle East and to analyze the cartoon protests and their impact on Europe. Dickey is also Newsweek's former Cairo bureau chief and has played a key role in the magazine's coverage of the war on terror. He went to a studio in Paris this morning to record our interview. Christopher Dickey, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's consider some of the things happening right now, mostly in the Middle East. We have the militant Islamic group Hamas now leading the Palestinian government. The militant Islamic group, the Muslim Brotherhood, did very well in the Egyptian parliamentary election. The militant Islamic group Hezbollah did well in the elections in Lebanon. Iran is pursuing its nuclear program in defiance of the International Atomic Energy Agency. The new Iranian president basically says Israel should be wiped off the map. Tens of thousands of Muslims have protested the Muhammad cartoons. People have been killed, embassies destroyed, death threats issued. And with the destruction yesterday of the shrine in Iraq, Iraq seems closer to a civil war. Are all these events happening in some kind of coincidental manner, or do you think that there's something larger that is connecting all of these issues and events?
I don't know if they're all completely connected, but there are some fundamental misconceptions and misapprehensions that are tending to drive these conflicts and create these problems, especially on the American side. There's a real genuine failure by American policymakers to address what are seen as central problems in the Arab and Muslim world. First among those is the question of occupation. We very rarely hear American officials talk about occupation and the problems that that can bring and the resentments that it creates. But the question of occupation, either directly with foreign forces, Israelis in Palestinian territories or American forces in Iraq, or indirectly with governments that are seen as essentially proxies or clients of the United States and the West, like Mubarak in Egypt, and to some extent King Abdullah in Jordan. All of that creates a huge amount of anger, and I don't think Americans really understand that. I know American policy doesn't begin to address that. You listen to Rumsfeld talking about problems with communication with the Arab world and the Muslim world, and he doesn't even begin to address the central issues for Arabs and Muslims, most of which revolve around this question of colonial history and present-day occupations.
Now, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in the Palestinian territories, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, are these groups connected in any way?
Well, Hezbollah is a slightly different element here. But Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood are intimately connected. Hamas was a creation, essentially, of the Muslim Brotherhood and is very close to it. It is the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, Muslim Brotherhood in Syria. Muslim Brotherhood internationally is an organization that dates back to the early part of the 20th century. It was founded in Egypt, and it was essentially an Islamic answer to fascist and communist parties of that time, and it has essentially adopted that kind of political and organizational model where it's got a very strong ideology, a very coherent organization, very committed cadre, and it is a very potentially a very powerful organization that has entered electoral politics in the past, in when that's been possible in the Arab and Muslim world, but has also been behind armed insurrections in places as diverse as Syria and of course in the Palestinian territories.
So, you use the word fascist when talking about the Muslim Brotherhood, and that they came of age in a time of fascism. Do you consider them a fascist group?
Not exactly. I think that when we use the word fascist in American society, it's very hard to understand. It's been denatured by a lot of political discourse over the years. What I mean is that they came into existence at the time when the powerful political forces in the world were fascism and communism, that were very organized parties, organized in very specific ways, with cadre, with ideology, with commitment, with a real zeal to take power using many different means. And maybe people who've grown up since the Cold War have forgotten that. But they are the last party that really is in existence today that sprang from that old-style ideology, old-style model of organization. And they are very effective because of that. And loose-knit democratic movements find it very difficult to stand against them. And dictatorships find that they mount a real challenge to their authority. But then again, the dictatorships use their own cruder means of power to suppress them. So that's what I'm talking about. I'm not saying that they admire Hitler. I'm saying that they use the kind of organization that Mussolini used, or that the Nazis used, or that the communists used to push their political program.
One of the paradoxes right now politically is that, you know, the Bush policy, the Bush foreign policy has been about democracy. His explanation now for invading Iraq is that, you know, we wanted a democratic government there. We wanted to get rid of Saddam Hussein and open it for democracy, and the idea was that democracy would spread. But we're close to civil war in Iraq. The democratic election in the Palestinian territory has led to a government led by an Islamist group, Hamas. In Egypt, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood did well in the parliamentary election. So, what do you see when you look at this paradox of a policy about democracy leading to elections that are making the West, democratic countries, unhappy?
Democracy is about organization, as the Bush administration certainly should know. And the parties that are organized that in the Muslim world are generally religious parties. The Muslim Brotherhood, Hezbollah, some other fundamentalist organizations. Partly because, dating back to the Cold War, the United States supported all kinds of measures to crush left-wing parties who were identified with Soviet interests, and often rightly so. So the only parties that were allowed to continue in existence were these right-wing Islamic groups. And when you have an election, the parties that are going to win are the ones that can get their loyal followers to go to the polls and vote. And in fact, that is what has happened in all those cases that you mentioned. And to say we want democracy and ignore the fact that the most coherent and disciplined political organizations are essentially groups of fundamentalist Muslims who were often guerrilla groups in the past is, I think, extremely naive. And of course, Iraq is another case. The two parties that dominate Iraqi political life now are the Shiite Dawa Party and the Shiite Skiri, Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, both of which were guerrilla groups originally, very tight-knit, lived in secrecy for a long time, suffered a lot of persecution, and have emerged as the most coherent, focused, militant, and successful political organizations in modern-day Iraq.
So are you saying that to call for democracy in the Middle East and expect that democracy to look like it does in the West is naive?
It certainly is, unless you're going to create an environment where more moderate parties can thrive and where they have a message that means something to people. You know, it's fine for us to say, gee, you know, free enterprise would be great, more democracy, more freedom for people to speak out and to live their lives just like we do would all be wonderful. But that doesn't really seem like a concrete offering in most of these societies. And when it comes to going to the polls, the people who are going to mobilize those votes are going to be people who are committed ideologues, not just people who think vaguely we'd like more freedom.
Christopher Dickey, as Newsweek's Middle East editor and Paris bureau chief, you know, and somebody who spends a lot of time in Europe and in the Middle East, you're in a kind of unique position to talk about the Khartoum protests. So I'd like to talk with you about that and see what you've been learning. The editor, the Danish editor who commissioned these cartoons, had a piece in the Washington Post yesterday. And in it he said that he commissioned the cartoons in response to several incidents of self-censorship in Europe caused by widening fears and feelings of intimidation with issues related to Islam. He said, "Our goal was simply to push back self-imposed limits on expression that seemed to be closing in tighter." And as examples of this kind of self-censorship, he offered this. A Danish children's writer had trouble finding an illustrator for a book about the life of Muhammad. Three people turned down the job for fear of consequences, and the person who finally accepted insisted on anonymity. And then European translators of a book critical of Islam didn't want their names to appear on the book cover, and one of the authors, a Somalia-born Dutch politician, has been in hiding.
Ayaan Hirsi Ali, yeah.
So, yeah, what are your impressions of his motives for commissioning these cartoons as a way to challenge this kind of self-censorship?
I think that initially the editor clearly had no idea this was going to be such a huge sensation. He thought he was making, I suspect, a fairly small statement in his newspaper in Denmark. And it has just gotten way, way out of control. But now he's justifying it as if we should have left it there to begin with. It should never have gotten blown up. Nobody should have paid any attention to it. And I have to say, I think that's naive in the current circumstances. Look, there are a lot in Europe, especially in Europe, there are all kinds of things that cannot be said. And
you're talking about hate crime laws.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, I think it's not, it's again, disingenuous and provocative for the Iranians to be saying, oh, well, let's promote Holocaust denial and test freedom of the press that way. But for Muslims in Europe and elsewhere, it's a legitimate question. Why is it that nothing can be said in that regard, and yet it's fine to caricature Muhammad and offend the sensibilities of Muslims? In American society, there are all sorts of words that we don't want to use in terms of race relations in the United States, or that may be okay for black people to use, but I wouldn't be okay for me to use. And we get used to those constraints. Is that a real limit on freedom of the press, or is that simply paying attention to people's sensibilities and understanding that there's a history, maybe a faith involved, and that ought to be taken into account? Now, as a journalist, as a writer, you know, I tend to be anarchic. I'd like to be able to say anything I want to say. But also, as somebody who looks at the world as it is, I think you have to recognize that sensibilities are out there and you're going to face a lot of anger.
What do the hate laws have to say about speech in European countries?
Well, it varies from country to country. But, of course, you just had an author, a historian, a Holocaust denier sentenced to jail in Austria. For writing a book and giving speeches in which he called into question the existence of the Holocaust. I mean, an evil, pernicious analysis of pseudo-history, if ever there was one. But should he be free to do that, or should he be thrown in jail for that? I don't know.
So, you know, again, the Danish editor says he published these cartoons to challenge self-censorship and it's the chilling effect. Do you think there is now, as a result, more self-censorship?
Well, obviously, there's a hell of a lot more self-censorship now. After he made his stand for children's book illustrators, we now have a situation where you have the governments of many European countries and you have major publications in the United States and elsewhere that are clearly more reluctant to publish those kinds of things, to address those kinds of problems head on, because they basically
What kind of problems?
Well, look, have you seen these cartoons published in major American publications?
Well, I know the Philadelphia Inquirer
The New York Times or the Washington Post.
No, I know the Philadelphia Inquirer published them.
Right, and it was a big deal
mm-hmm.
for them to publish them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that in another environment we might have had a situation in which lots of places would have published them. But because of the reaction, because nobody wants to be responsible for a situation where people are getting killed, even if this is just an excuse for the riots, there's a lot more self-censorship than there was before.
What are you hearing from editors in Europe? And I know you were just in Italy. Were you talking to people in the press there?
Yeah, I think that in Italy, you have a lot of people who are afraid, including in the government right now, because they have a very volatile situation. They sent troops to Iraq, so they're afraid of being targeted by terrorists either inside Europe or as part of some larger plot. They were afraid of that before. Then you have this you know, very irresponsible minister with his T-shirt with Muhammad cartoons suddenly making this move. And there was something like panic in the Italian government because the last thing they want is to be seen to have provoked outrage that then results in some kind of terrorist attack or that people claim is the reason for a terrorist attack. If we could backtrack on this issue just one second, we keep focusing on the cartoons. The cartoons provide a pretext for all kinds of discontents in lots of different countries. One of the things that happened in Libya, where 14 people were killed, is that a protest was allowed against the cartoons that suddenly started to sound very much like a protest against the Gaddafi government. In Damascus and then in Beirut, where the Danish embassies were burned, those were really staged events. Those were not out of control. And those had to do with pushing back Europe, intimidating Europe, showing that the Syrians were not going to give in to Europe on issues that have nothing to do with the cartoons. So you have the cartoon issue exploited a lot in the Arab and Muslim world by groups with their own political agendas that use this as an excuse. And I think that has to be understood. But at the same time, you have a lot of provocation and a lot of game playing by certain politicians in Europe. You mentioned Ayaan Hirsi Ali. You know, she is a woman who was born in Somalia, grew up in Saudi Arabia, has essentially rejected...
This is the children's book.
She's a member of parliament, and she's a Dutch member
of
parliament.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, she wasn't the children's book person. She was the person who was writing a history of Islam that was critical of...
Critical hardly touches it.
I mean, I see.
She is Ayaan Hirsi Ali is a very intelligent, very articulate woman who speaks out in favor of what you and I think would see as classic Western freedoms. But she does this in a context of militantly, even violently rejecting traditional Islamic teachings and to a large extent traditional Islamic values. And she makes a frontal attack on Islam, and she was the woman who wrote the script for the film that was made by Theo van Gogh that eventually resulted in his being murdered by an Islamic radical in Holland. So she's not exactly a passive actor in this, just a woman who's hiding out because she said a few provocative things. She's been actively... As provocative as she possibly can be, stretching the limits of freedom. And, frankly, there are times when you listen to her and you read her and you think, that's right. Let's push freedom to its limits. Let's not let these ideologues, religious ideologues, intimidate us and co-opt us and terrify us. But I would simply say, let's also not think that the only group that's likely to try to do that is a Muslim group. There are certainly groups in the United States that try to use their religious authority, their moral authority, to intimidate people, to limit free speech, and to limit what can be said and, to some extent, even thought. And I think that there's a big problem when we talk about the Muslim world that we tend to identify all these problems only with Islam, and we miss the fact that it's really a problem of fundamentalism in any religion, where you basically say, we have got the received truth, and anybody who doesn't agree with our received truth doesn't really have a right to speak. And that certainly is not unique to Islam.
You know, watching the protests and the riots around the Islamic world in response to the Muhammad cartoons, it's easy to wonder, where are the moderate Muslim leaders? Why aren't there more people standing up and calling for a more peaceful protest? I mean, people are getting killed.
Well, there are people standing up and calling for more peaceful protests. There are journalists who are sometimes taking very brave positions. There have been Arab journalists who've published these cartoons and are now under indictment in a couple of different countries, in Yemen and in Jordan, for having published these cartoons in the context of saying, let's look this issue in its face, let's condemn what's being done, and let's find a reasonable response to it. And that they have now run afoul of the radicals and to some extent government officials who want to play to those radical elements in their own countries. But there are voices standing up. There have been lots of peaceful protests. But it is the nature of the news business, I'm sad to say, that peaceful protests don't get as much attention as 12 or 14 people being gunned down.
Yesterday in Iraq, men blew up a Shia mosque in a largely Sunni town. And I know we don't officially know yet who was behind this. But, you know, you have to wonder about how there were such protests to cartoons. And I know there were huge protests in Iraq to the destruction of this mosque. But there weren't huge protests that I know of around the rest of the Islamic world.
Well, not yet. There certainly were protests in Iran as well, and probably Iran will find other ways to exploit this situation. But it is true that the Muslim world has a lot of sectarian differences. They may unite around the idea that a Danish cartoonist or collection of Danish cartoonists should not be drawing parodies of the Prophet Muhammad. But that doesn't mean that they're united on everything else. And in fact, there are terrible differences among them. And attacks on mosques in Iraq, on Shia mosques particularly, have become commonplace. But one of the things that's going on is the Shia leadership in Iraq sees these as provocations intended to create a sectarian Sunni-Shia war. And the Shia leadership, Ayatollah Sistani most conspicuously, doesn't want that to happen. So instead of inflaming passions, what the Shia clergy in Iraq have been saying is, stay cool. Don't go out and take revenge. And even with those efforts at restraint, it looks like dozens of people have been killed in the riots and retributions that have taken place over the last day and a half. But there you have an issue of leadership where leaders are being listened to. It's, you know, again, as I say, we have a fairly disciplined electorate there and a fairly disciplined society, Shia society in Iraq, that listens to what Ayatollah Sistani says. And so it's been muted. Your question was about the wider problem. Why have there not been huge riots everywhere? Well, there are not that many areas where there are really large Shia populations. Iraq, Iran, southern Lebanon, southern Beirut, and some in Pakistan, and then some in Saudi Arabia. But other than that, those would be the places you would expect to see reaction, and you saw it in Iran and Iraq.
You recently wrote about the new Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And would you tell us a little bit about his background? And just to refresh people's memory, he is acting in defiance of the International Atomic Energy Agency and in continuing to pursue Iran's nuclear program. He's also basically called for Israel to be wiped off the map. What's his background? What's his resume?
Well, he comes from a very humble beginnings, as they say. His father was a blacksmith. They moved from a little town on the edge of the desert to one of the slums of Tehran when he was 1 year old. And he grew up in an environment where it was hard to get a job, hard to get an education, hard to get ahead. And then the revolution happened in 1978 and 79, and like many other young Iranians, he was drawn to that and soon became involved with some of the most radical and best-known elements of that revolution. He was not involved directly in the hostage-taking at the U.S. Embassy, but he knew the people who were involved with it. And eventually he went out to the Kurdish areas during the war with Iraq and worked his way up through the Revolutionary Guards and through revolutionary administration then. And he eventually found his calling as a populist politician. He's unlike, for instance, Ali Larijani, who's another powerful political figure, who's the main nuclear negotiator, who comes from a family of ayatollahs, and in that sense has had all the advantages. This guy, he's gotten ahead by playing to popular prejudices, popular beliefs, simplistic beliefs, whether about the corruption of other Iranian politicians and clergy, or about Israel, or about national pride in developing nuclear technology. And he used that very, very successfully to get himself elected from the limited field of candidates who were permitted to run in Iran last year. And, of course, he's thrust himself onto the international stage again and again by saying things that he knew would be outrageous to the international community, but at the same time that he knew would have a kind of simplistic appeal to his core audience, who are people from backgrounds more or less like his. And he's been very successful with that, politically in Iran.
Well, you've also written that he plays to a nostalgia for war among parts of Iran's leadership and even some of its young people. What do you mean by that?
Well, in Iran, the clerical leadership, certain parts of it, look back on the period from the revolution in 78-79 up through the war against Iraq, all through the 80s, it ended in 1988, as their finest hour. But that's not actually that unusual. A lot of people who've gone through a war look back on the war with a sort of nostalgia. That's when our motives were pure. That's when we really knew what we were doing. We had direction. We had commitment. We had courage. We made sacrifices. And all the people were behind us. And that is the kind of thinking that dominates the Ahmadinejad generation. They were made by war and revolution. And to settle back and try to lead the life of contented bazaaris doesn't interest them very much. They see those people as corrupt, and they see the efforts at westernization, liberalization, opening up to the West that took place through most of the 1990s as weakening the revolution, weakening its commitment, weakening its ideology, and most importantly, perhaps, weakening their grip on power. So he really is trying to... Ahmadinejad is himself, and he represents a movement to roll the clock back, to raise problems anew that were resolved or seemed to be on their way to resolution. The Arab world has spent more than a decade trying to say that the Palestinian-Israeli issue is essentially a Palestinian-Israeli issue, not a pan-Arab, not a pan-Muslim issue. And Ahmadinejad is saying, no, it's our issue. It's Iran's issue. We want to deal with this. We want to make a big deal out of it. We want to use this for confrontation. So that's the game he's playing.
Well, you say that the new Iranian president wants to kind of confront the Israel-Palestine question, and the secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, in talking about the new Hamas-led government and in addressing the fact that the U.S. and Israel plan to withhold money and aid, has said, "We will definitely help this Hamas government financially in order to resist America's cruelty." So is Iran trying to set this up as being about America, too?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning. Iran understands very clearly that this issue of occupation, humiliation, subjugation, use any of those words you want, is one that has a lot of resonance in the Arab and the Muslim world. So Hamas presents itself now as the legitimately elected government of the Palestinian territories and immediately claims that it's being persecuted by Israel and isolated by Israel. It is being isolated by Israel and by the United States and by Europe. And Iran says, "We're there to help you because we understand what you're all about. You're fighting against occupation. You're fighting for your liberation. And we support that." It's just absolutely ready-made. Even if not a penny of Iranian money ever actually makes it to Hamas or to the Palestinians, it's just ready-made as a propaganda issue for Tehran.
With Iran saying now that it will support Hamas, does that is that a new alliance? Does that change in any fundamental way the political alliances within the Middle East?
Iran has been supporting Hamas to some extent for a long time, but the core support for Hamas has come from the Arab countries of the Gulf over the long term. We just saw that Condoleezza Rice was in Saudi Arabia and asked the Saudis to cut off support for the Hamas government in the Palestinian territories, and the Saudis said, no, we're not going to do that. So I think we're going to see a lot of movement around the question of who supports Hamas and why. The simple discourse that Hamas is a terrorist organization, while certainly that's true in Israeli terms, is not something that many Arabs and Muslims believe. They see it as an organization using whatever means are at its disposal to fight against occupation, and they're going to continue trying to support it.
So how would you describe the American policy right now toward Iran?
I think that the American-European policy toward Iran, which are very similar, is in a real bind, and the Iranians know that. Essentially, the Iranians understand not just Ahmadinejad, but also Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader, and Ali Larijani, the nuclear negotiator. They all understand very well that as long as oil prices are up around $60 a barrel and the market is as tight as it is, nobody's going to risk imposing serious sanctions on Iran that will result in a major cutback of Iranian oil exports. If you did that, either because you impose sanctions on Iranian oil or because the Iranians themselves decide to shut off the taps, you'd see oil heading up around $100 a barrel. And the economic effects around the world, and especially in the United States, would be enormous. So that's not going to be the case forever. Within the next 3 years, there'll be more Saudi oil coming online. There'll be more oil from other OPEC and non-OPEC countries is likely to come online. And there will start to be more flexibility in the market. But for the time being, they know that they're protected by this. That's why they're rushing ahead. And that's why the European policy is freeze your nuclear enrichment program. Don't do this. Just wait a while longer. Because right now, the Europeans and the Americans have virtually no coercive measures that they can use effectively against Iran, and Iran knows it. So it's rushing to push ahead with its enrichment program as quickly as it possibly can, and doesn't see any reason to give in to any of the diplomatic initiatives that have been taken so far.
You know, we're using your visit to Fresh Air today as an opportunity to look at the larger Middle East region. I'm wondering how you see the new president of Iran and his more militant and provocative policies as affecting the larger region. Like, what influence is his government going to have on the region?
It's going to be profoundly destabilizing for the region because Iran does not see itself as playing a constructive role building positive alliances, even with like-minded governments. There aren't many like-minded governments. If it comes right down to it, it is the only fundamentalist Shiite regime that exists. And it is in a region where the Saudis are not sympathetic to that. Certainly the Jordanians are not. It sees itself as surrounded by American, either countries occupied by the United States or that are clients of the United States, Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, and so on. It's trying to assert its authority. It's trying to assert its influence. It's doing that by being provocative and by trying to show the weakness of the United States and of the West. And so it's going to be a very big destabilizing factor for the foreseeable future.
Do you think that the new Iranian president is likely to try to create a stronger alliance with the Shia majority in Iraq?
Absolutely. And it's not just him. It's the supreme leader. It's the whole clerical establishment. And for a lot of different reasons. First of all, they have a very long border with Iraq. They see Iraq as strategically the most important neighbor they have. They are not going to permit the United States if they have any say about it. They're not going to permit the United States to set up a long-term presence in Iraq with military bases and the possibility of eventually launching military actions out of Iraq. That's just not something that Iran will tolerate. And it will use every method at its disposal to make sure that doesn't happen. At the same time, the parties that have come to power in Iraq as a result of the election sponsored by the United States are parties that are essentially beholden not to Washington, but to Tehran, which gave them asylum, which gave them protection at a time when the U.S. was backing Saddam Hussein back in the 1980s and denouncing these same groups, like the Dawa, as terrorist organizations. So they have a long history, lots of contacts, very deep, deep penetration of Iraqi society. As you know, Ayatollah Sistani, the leading figure in Shia political life in Iraq, is Iranian. Ali Larijani, this very important figure in Iran, was born in Iraq. We as Americans don't have any counterweight to offer to that, and the Iranians know that. So they are going to exploit this situation. Whoever is in charge in Iran is going to exploit this situation for the national interests of Iran in the short, the medium, and the very long term.
My guest is Christopher Dickey. He's Newsweek's Middle East editor and Paris bureau chief. And we've been basically taking a political tour of the Middle East and looking at the recent changes there and what their effects might be. I'd like to end our little tour at home in the United States with a look at this proposed deal with Dubai Ports World, the group based in the United Arab Emirates that is... the deal was made for them to take over control or partial control of six ports in American cities.
Essentially of the loading operations, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of people are really confused about what this deal is really about and what it would mean. Do you see this as largely just like a business deal? Or a political deal, a deal with two countries what do you see as the subtext of this deal is, I guess, what I'd like to know. Is it about an ally in the war on terror? Is it a business deal? Is it,
Well, essentially it was treated as a business deal, and it was a business deal. It's partly a factor of the United States wanting to participate in a global economy that usually works to the benefit of the United States, but in order to do that, you have to make American assets available to foreign buyers. Those port facilities are enormously worthwhile assets, and a lot of foreign buyers are interested in them. It's not only Dubai Ports, but Dubai Ports managed to put the deal together. And I think President Bush is worried about a situation where you say no to Dubai Ports because why? Because you're Arabs. And that's definitely not the kind of message that he wants to send to America's rather uneasy Arab friends at this moment. And I think he's very clear about that. He thinks it's sending a very bad signal. On the other hand, ports are not only a source of security concern, they're also a source of, if you will, nationalist pride. They're the gateways to the United States. Symbolically, it has a lot of resonance when you say we're selling our ports to foreign powers or to foreign governments or to companies owned by foreign governments, even if those governments are not Arab. But you put all that together and you have really the mess that we see today.
What can you tell us about the government of the United Arab Emirates, which owns this company?
Well, there are really seven governments in the United Arab Emirates. It's a loose coalition of principalities or city-states, if you will. And by far the most dynamic is Dubai. The richest one is Abu Dhabi. It's got most of the oil, and it is sort of number one among equals in the Emirates. But Dubai has been much more creative. I first started going there about 20 years ago, and it was a collection of a few duty-free shopping centers between the sand and the sea, if you will. And before that, it was kind of a ramshackle smuggling center for people taking gold into India. But in the last 20 years, it's developed into this huge hub, and a big part of that has been the duty-free port and the dry dock and other port facilities that were built in the 1980s and that are the core business of Dubai ports. So they've got a lot of experience in developing very modern ports and port facilities, and they now have a huge influx of capital because oil prices are so high that money has just been pouring into Dubai as one of the best places in the Arab world to invest. And the growth of the stock market there is just phenomenal. The growth of the real estate market is unbelievable. We're talking well over 100% a year. So as a result, there's a lot of capital and a lot of expertise, and they decided to go shopping for what looked like good deals to them. And those ports in the United States, they originally approached the British owners, looked like a good deal for them.
It seems, if I understand things correctly, that the governments of the United Arab Emirates have been cooperating in the war on terror, and yet two of the September 11th hijackers were citizens of the UAE.
Yeah, they were citizens of Ras Al Khaimah, which is one of the poorest of the Emirates. But this is a Dubai thing, really. It's not so much a UAE thing. And Dubai is an interesting place. It's a little bit like Istanbul during World War I, or Beirut back in the old days. It's before the war. It's one of these places that's full of intrigue because it's basically a free port. Anybody can move in and out of there, not only in terms of shipping, but flying in and flying out. There are no taxes to speak of, and it's just an area where there's been laissez-faire commerce for a very long time. It attracts not only lots of Iranians, but lots of Russians, Ukrainians, all kinds of people go to Dubai, and it's an enormous tourist mecca for the British and for other Europeans, but especially for the British. It's got some of the most fabulous luxury hotels in the world. So it's not... You know, it's not this idea. I was reading Maureen Dowd's column today in which she conflated American allies in the Muslim world, and she sort of ran down a list that obviously was drawn from everybody from Egypt to Pakistan and made it seem as if she was talking about Dubai. But that isn't Dubai at all. Dubai is about commerce first and last. And if that makes it a place where people launder money, that certainly has been that in the past. If it's a place where people sometimes move contraband goods, it certainly has been that. Then that's all true. But it's not. It's also a place where the CIA has had a very big station for a very long time, because it's a place where you can meet lots of people and get lots of information. And it's not the kind of place that the Bush administration would really like to alienate.
But what about how it might hurt our security at the ports to have this deal?
I think that the Bush administration has a lot of explaining to do about the way security is handled. What we read is that there are extensive briefings on the security arrangements for these companies, and they are enlisted to cooperate. So does that mean that we're telling them all the sources and methods that we use for homeland security, these foreign companies? Put aside Dubai, Chinese companies, other companies, we're telling them all this information? Is that the way we want to handle homeland security? Well, that's a real question. But I'm not sure that the most effective way to deal with that is to say that foreigners can't buy the ports. It may be that we just, and we know that we need to do this anyway, we need to reorganize Homeland Security and make it a hell of a lot more efficient organization than it is.
Do you think that we are heading towards some kind of larger war between the Islamic world and the West?
Well, the Islamic world, as we talked about, is not a one coherent world. But to the extent that the West gets trapped into a situation of provocation and prejudice and fails to understand certain key issues that create common resentments really across the Muslim world, then I think we are at risk of creating, if not one big conflagration, one little fire and one medium-sized fire after another for the foreseeable future. And that will increase resentment, that will increase hatred, and eventually it could lead to, if not certainly not a world war, but it could lead to all kinds of persecutions and anger and violence.
Well, Christopher Dickey, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's always a pleasure.
Christopher Dickey is Newsweek's Middle East Regional Editor and Paris Bureau Chief. His latest book is a novel about terrorism called The Sleeper. He spoke to us from Paris. Our interview was recorded this morning.